This is The Fall Line. A little less than a year ago, friends made us aware that a podcaster in New England was doing work on cold cases in Maine and surrounding states that we'd be interested in. And they were right. We were introduced to Kristen Seavey, a seasoned actor and storyteller whose interest in deep research was one of the reasons she felt driven to start her podcast, Murder, She Told. The name is an homage to Jessica Fletcher and the TV show Murder, She Wrote, which was, of course, set in Maine. But her interest in crime wasn't Kristen's only reason for beginning her work. For years, she noticed that New England cases, but most especially Maine cold cases, were less likely to be featured in mainstream press and on TV. And in a state that does not allow billboards, families hoping to reach audiences in their own region to make them aware of missing or murdered loved ones, they faced an uphill battle. Kristen decided to begin her own show to cover those cases. Like the stories we bring you on The Fall Line, she focuses on victims who have scant digital footprint and who other creators are unlikely to cover. She works directly with friends and family. And, most striking to us, she is a certified victims advocate. In a landscape where ethics, trauma, and consent are coming to the forefront as important topics of discussion, we found that to be an incredibly important distinction. I sat down with Kristen to talk about New England cold cases, how she creates her show, what being a victim advocate does and doesn't mean, and how creators and listeners can better advocate for cases and victims, and in partnership with families and survivors. We think you'll find this conversation really interesting, and we have the feeling that there will be more shows like Kristen's appearing as the genre continues to examine itself. Murder, She Told has some things in common with The Fall Line, in that it's family-centric. Can you talk about your vision for the show when it began? What did you want the show to do?
I knew from the start that I wanted to focus more on the victims and their families. Something that always bothered me as a consumer of true crime is that the victim's life was usually treated as a footnote to the story about their death. I wanted to know more about who they were as a person, what their life was like up to that point, what the circumstances were, because their life doesn't start the day that they were killed. There's just so much more to the story that I didn't feel like I was hearing on most other shows and wasn't available in newspaper research. And I wanted to hear it from the people that knew it best. So the show is the family stories too, and I wanted to give them a place to share their story.
So on that note, what kind of agency or role do you offer families and loved ones in terms of how their stories are told?
So I work with a lot of older people, and most have no idea what a podcast even is. So we usually send them one of the blogs if they have a computer, which sometimes they actually don't, and so that they can see the photos of the victim and read it or listen to it on the blog and get a sense of what we're going for. I think a lot of the times that will speak for itself, and if not, I just explain who I am, what I'm doing, what I'm looking to tell for the story, and just try to be as respectful as possible. We usually spend about at least 5 hours talking to the family between the time that it gets recorded and then just off the record conversations. We don't really include the family in the writing process, but I try to really listen to them and hear what they want. You know, I've had families go with me to look at the court file for a conviction case that went through the system. It's really flexible just depending on the family and what they want. I think, though, that by the time we're done talking with them and working with them, that there's a level of trust that we're going to take care of them, that we're on their side, that this is their story and we're here to support it. So I do feel good about what we're putting out. And then, of course, if there's ever anything that needs to be changed, you know, I'm happy to change anything or keep anything out and share in the process up to that point.
So it sounds like you're doing a lot of this in person. So I think I kind of have an answer to my next question, but you have a general regional focus for the show. with some space to extend if necessary, kind of like we do. Can you talk about that choice and why you made it?
Maine rarely makes the mainstream media, and I almost never hear Maine cases on bigger podcasts. We do do a lot of work over the phone as well, but during the pandemic, I started to look into cases that were on the unsolved homicide list. And I was actually really surprised that for somebody who's always been interested in true crime, how little I actually knew about the cases that happened in my own backyard and how little was available online. I mean, I grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries. I know all of the big familiar cases that everyone else does, but I didn't know about the case that's still unsolved that happened in the next town over. You know, a lot of these cases, there's just very little online. There's like an annual Facebook blurb that's posted by the state police, and that's about it. And a key part of solving cold cases is people talking about them and coming forward with information. So in my mind, I was like, if people don't know about these cases or aren't actively talking about them, how are they going to get solved? I mean, obviously, it's not as simple as that. I wish it were. But, you know, that is a really big part of it, especially for cases that don't have DNA. So I knew that I wanted this to be focused on Maine and the New England region and give these cases that weren't being told on other podcasts a platform to be heard.
When you talk about your focus on unsolved cases and on victims and families, it was really striking to me that seemed to carry through kind of everything that you do. I was looking at some photos from the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, and I noticed something really interesting about your booth. So I was kind of spying on you. But instead of having a big display of your own merch, which would be totally fine, you know, lots of people do it, you had set up a dozen or so photos of, I believe, victims displayed in different size frames like you would family photos. And it wasn't kind of a haphazard setup. It was really carefully done. And it was like you were displaying pictures of your own loved ones for people at the festival to see. And I just found that so touching and so deliberate. And it kind of spoke to me about why I wanted to interview in the first place, your approach to crime, ethics and crime, connecting with families, what you want the show to do. It's a visceral reminder that people are at the root of this content. So I would love to talk about kind of your intention or message or just thoughts behind that choice.
I'm so proud of how that came out. This was our first festival, so I'm definitely an overachiever in that. But really, with that choice, I wrote in a caption on a photo that the heart of the show sits on that table. And I wanted that to be reflected by the table itself. I wanted people to look at that and think about their own family and care about the people in the frames, even if it's just for that moment, and care about the fact that there's 15 faces that are looking back at you that don't have justice. Like I mentioned, it's our first festival. So my partner and I wanted to have the table be more than just stickers on a table. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That's fine. But we also wanted to create some visibility for the cases that we've covered. So it was actually his idea to have some photos in frames. And then I was like, I want them all to be unsolved. I want them all to be unsolved cases. So there's only so much room on the table. So we only had, I think, 15. And the whole process of that actually took time. It took work to create. We went to Goodwill and we bought a bunch of old frames. I really wanted them to feel warm and a bit worn, like grandma's mantle. And so we cleaned them. I picked out ones that looked very like 80s and 90s. We measured them. We picked the photos. And then we had them printed at Staples, which was terrible. They looked so bad. So we did some research and found this like place that did like classic photographs, which is funny that you can't really find that anymore. But we basically just had them overnighted to the hotel and they were perfect. I think it was really powerful. And I think it speaks for itself what the show is about, which is the victims. I also wanted the table to reflect the advocacy. So there was a link to a petition, and then there was this binder that featured Reeves Johnson's case file for people to look through. I have a feeling that we're going to be seeing more tables like that because there are a lot of podcasters that came up to me and said, oh, I want to do that. I'm like, you know, if it inspires more people to think about, you know, the victims being the face of these stories, for it being their stories, then absolutely, I would love to see more of that.
Well, I think it comes back to that question that we're always all kind of either struggling with or balancing or at least considering, which is entertainment, ethics, the value of the work, right? We have to involve people in a story to keep them listening. This is something that I've talked to Sarah Turney about a lot, but these are people's lives. When you're approaching that as a storyteller, how do you keep that in mind?
It's a really hard balance sometimes because at the end of the day, no matter what we're doing to offset and help bring justice, how compassionate we are, a podcast episode is still a form of entertainment. So when we write and shape the story, we really, really try to keep the family in mind and also keep my narrator opinion separate from the story and not focus on the sensational aspects or make them more sensational or gossipy, either through the writing or the way that I tell it. I find that a lot of the families that I've worked with so far are okay with details as long as they're correct and they're done respectfully. They just really want things to be correct. That being said, you know, there's a way to do it and then a way not to do it, and that's a balance. Like, is it gratuitous? Am I being gossipy? Do we need to bring this up again? Is it important to the story? How is a family going to feel when they listen to it? I really just try to keep them in mind throughout the entire process. And that's kind of the through line of how we write episodes. You know, if somebody was a sex worker or a drug addict, it's just part of their story. It's not something that needs to be sensationalized or anything like that. You know, sometimes this type of work, it's not for everybody in the true crime space. I get a lot of comments like, it's boring, you're boring. There's a lot of useless information in here, but the useless information being the victim's life when telling the story about their murder. I think that a lot of true crime audiences in general are so conditioned to hearing the story starting with the murder, or, you know, seeing this crazy story in a viral Netflix show or hearing about it, this like campfire spooky story kind of way, that when you hear a show like mine or like yours, where it doesn't just cut to the murder and glom onto the killer or the crazy details, they're like, wow, this is so boring. You know, personally, I'd really like to see that shift and focus more on the ethics of the storytelling and less on the entertainment value of the storytelling.
Yeah, sorry, I was laughing just because that was hauntingly familiar.
Right?
I believe I've gotten that email and or review. I think that you can especially speak to some of this because of all the people I've talked to, you are actually a certified victims advocate. And that term is used so often lately, you know, and a lot of people advocate, which is a wonderful thing. Many of us engage in advocacy in different ways, but you're actually certified. So I'd love to dig into that a little, as you're the first certified victims advocate I've been able to speak to. And I know you kind of warned me ahead of time. There are different types of advocacy, and you're going to get into that a little bit. But first, I'd like to kind of start with what the concept of a victims advocate actually is and what that might entail, maybe what it should entail in podcasting. And even if you're comfortable kind of talking about the responsibility that comes with people self-labeling as advocates within the community as well.
So a victims advocate can be a lot of things. And like you mentioned, it is a term that is used sometimes a little too loosely. I've always considered myself a victims advocate in that I stood on the family side. I advocate for the victims and sought to tell their stories on the show. You know, just like a general focus on the victims, I think as podcasters can be a self-label for being a victims advocate. But I was working with so many families, I just felt like I wanted to go the extra mile and put myself through training and on a path to get credentials just to have that under my belt and know that when we're working with families, I'm not re-traumatizing them without even knowing it. The topic of trauma is just really complex and personal, and it varies from person to person. I also just wanted people to know that I was serious about this. And I think having gone through the training gives people who are opening up to us confidence that we're serious about this and we're serious about supporting them. And we have those resources in our pocket to help them as well. I haven't done any like career field work. I am just on a provisional level, but I have a fancy card that says that I'm a credentialed victims advocate. And
I'm looking at it right now
hang in the office that I don't have yet. But in all seriousness, like a victim's advocate is also a job. And, you know, this like the state usually has victim's advocates who work with and support victims who need to testify in court or work with the cold case unit or help with resources for families who have been victimized or people. You know, the term victim, too, I really learned through this process is much bigger than just victims of violent crimes. So when I was going through training, I learned about like financial crimes, elder abuse, military crimes, just a wide array of crimes and situations that, you know, a victim would come from. You know, families of homicides are considered victims too. They're bereavement victims, at least in a textbook. Everyone in my class actually was in a degree program to eventually hold a job in like social work or law enforcement. And this was just a step in the process, except for me, who was taking the class with the intention of, you know, applying for the credentials. A lot of people will self-label as advocates. I was certainly one of them. I called myself a victims advocate before having like the physical credential that I do now. As an advocate certified through NOVA, I have to basically sign like an agreement that I'm agreeing to standards, that I'm agreeing to the ethics, and that I'm going to uphold those ethics. And honestly, it wasn't anything different than I was already doing. So I think that the people who are saying they're victims advocates and doing advocate work in like podcasting also have to hold themselves to this list of ethics. And really, it just involves like supporting the victims, not being sensational, you know, not being gratuitous with the information, and really asking yourself, like, is this detail important or am I just doing it, you know, for clicks and likes? Just stuff like that, that really keeps the family in mind, keeps the victims in focus and less on the entertainment value.
Can you imagine any potential pitfalls that can happen when we engage in advocacy without training or lived experience or both? And if so, like, what would be a good way to avoid them for someone who wants to do good?
So on the advocates level, there was actually an entire chapter on self-care as an advocate because it can be a lot and the burnout rate is super high. And I think that for people who work with families and identify as advocates, one of the easiest pitfalls is not taking care of yourself and becoming detached from the work and the empathy of the work, you know, which also applies to doing episodes and podcasting and researching and working with all of these families. You're absorbing and supporting other people's trauma, especially for people who have a lot of empathy or consider themselves an empath. It can be really harmful if you don't balance out, you know, there's just a higher risk of becoming detached. As far as like considering yourself an advocate without that training, I think that just being really mindful of the questions that you're asking, how you're approaching people, their responses, because everybody's trauma is different, it's just really hard to navigate, you know, like, you can navigate it with empathy and compassion, you know, awareness and respect, but still there is a potential, even when doing everything right, that you could re-traumatize somebody just by picking up the phone and being like, hey, can we talk about, you know, your daughter's cold case? So I think just really keeping that in mind and just being careful with how you navigate stuff and letting them talk, you know?
That's a big thing that Brooke always says too. I've listened to Brooke do a lot of interviews, and she does very little talking. The things she says are very important, and the questions she asks are very important, but she does a lot of listening.
I think listening is probably my biggest advice. Like, even as somebody who does have training and credentials, I'm still open to learning and listening from the people that I'm talking to, from the families that I'm working with. Just listen to them. A lot of the times they haven't been listened to in the kind of way that you're trying to listen to them. So I think it's really important to them too, that they're being heard more than just a quote for a newspaper or a little 30-second snippet for a news clip. Like, they're telling their whole story in a way that's never been heard, and they're trusting you with that. So yeah, listening is extremely important.
When you say that, I immediately think of all the work you've done on the Reeves K. Johnson case. And that's actually one of the first things I looked into about your show and was super impressed. So I'm hoping you can talk to us about the case and your role, and specifically how the show came to kind of leading to you to do more.
So here's the nutshell of this case. Reeves Johnson was a 31-year-old man. He was living in Kittery, Maine, and working in Exeter, New Hampshire. In February of 1983, he left for work and he was never seen again. In the weeks after his disappearance, despite the fact that he was extremely frugal, his checkbook was used for very large and extravagant purchases to the point where his bank account ended up closing and the checks bounced. His cabin was emptied of valuables, but there was no evidence of foul play, and Reeves was an adult, so the police could only do so much. At the time, people said that they saw him around town and, you know, somebody called up his work pretending to be him, so they really didn't know if he was alive or not. 3 weeks after his disappearance, his parents came up from Philly to do a stakeout of the post office, hoping that Reeves would come to pick up his final check. And when they did, there was an unknown man with the key to his mailbox who came in and stole the check. His mother confronted him and snapped a photo of him before he left the post office. And when she developed the film, she realized that he put his hand up and blocked his face. First of all, that photo, it just blows my mind. It is just such a mystery, and it's such an intriguing part of this case and a tragic part of this case, knowing that she was maybe so close to the person that killed her son. And that's it. The photo was never circulated. We have no idea who that man is. Basically, after that, the case went dormant until October of 2021, when Detective Kummer of the Kittery Police Department decided to reopen the case. And we've kind of been helping behind the scenes. In November, I called him up when I saw that article. There was an article in Seacoast Online, Portsmouth Herald. And I was like, I've never heard this name before. Like, why don't I know about this case? That's because there is nothing on this case. There's no hit on the internet at all. So I called up Detective Kummer and I told him who I was and what I do and told him about the show. We talked on the phone a little bit and we were given access to the case file and complete permission by the family and the police chief to use them for the episode. And we produced an episode with the family and I helped get them some press and get Reeves' name circulating again and get that photo out there.
So this was your first time having access to a police file, right?
Yes.
How was that process different for you in terms of your research process?
Well, what was different about it is just that I knew I had the full support of the police department behind me. And also, I just knew that everything that is on this case is sitting on this table right now. There is nothing that I do not have unless it's in somebody's head. So when I'm digging for other cases, I'm like, there's got to be something out there. Like, I have to find more information. I have to go look at microfilm. I have to file to apply to get documents and just get every little scrap of information. And working on that, I was like, okay, this is it. This is all we've got. So that was different because it is still such limited information. And that's been kind of our uphill battle. You know, we're still hopeful that there's stuff out there, but it's been an uphill battle. But it's just interesting knowing that, like, there is nothing else out there. I know everything that the family knows. I know everything that the police know. And now I'm giving that to you, the public.
Can you talk about what's developed since your episode came out?
So somewhere in this process, it went from us doing an episode on the case to us being on the investigating team with the police on this case. And I think it is a testament to the level of research that we're doing. And I mean, we just go so nitty gritty on the research sometimes and digging, digging for like the most boring and minute things that are still either super important or partially important, but leads to something more. So since then, we've really been brainstorming ways to get Reeves' name out there. There is no physical evidence in this case at all. So really, we need to find people who knew him. And that's the thing that we haven't really like tapped into, because he was kind of, I don't want to say a loner, but he was not very social. We have not met any of his friends, and we haven't met any coworkers who really, really knew him. So it's been really difficult trying to find. All the records are gone, you know, like financial records, bank account stuff, all of that's gone. So really, we're just trying to get his name out there in hopes that somebody will see that news broadcast and be like, oh yeah, I remember that case. So basically, other than just like the episode itself, I did this big press release to try to get as many news outlets putting this out there as possible, and just brainstorming other ways to make that happen. I basically came up with the idea of a reward. And in June, we co-hosted this event with the Kittery Police Department, and it was a success. It was the first like live Murder, She Told event. And, you know, we did it in conjunction with the Kittery Police Department. We got the community to come out and kind of rally behind the case. And then the chief announced a reward of $6,000. And that's literally just pooled from my pocket, the family, Detective Comer, and the Kittery Police Department. And we got news channels to come out. And it was just a really great event that I was really proud of. I also organized a flyer street team at the Kittery block party, because I was like, man, the whole community is going to be out. Somebody here has to be a local who lived here in the 70s. So we did like a street team. And I also talked about his case in Texas at the True Crime Podcast Festival. So his 40th anniversary is coming up. So we have a meeting soon to kind of see what we can do to just keep this going and keep getting his name out there. Because unfortunately, with the media, it's really tricky, because they're like, well, have you solved the case? No. Okay, well, just call us when you do. And I'm like, no, but there is stuff that's happening. You know, it's just not like important in the way that they deem it's newsworthy or important that way.
Another case I know is really close to your heart is Danielle Bertolini. Can you talk about her case and your connection to the case and some of the struggles you've had gaining attention and traction for her case?
So Danielle Bertolini was a childhood friend of mine. And in 2014, in February of 2014, she was murdered in Humboldt County, California. She was picked up in a car in the Swains Flat area of Fortuna by a friend of an acquaintance, and his name is Jim Jones, and she was never seen again. About a year later, her remains were found deep in the woods by the Eel River. Just before Danielle went missing, there was another woman who went missing named Sheila Franks. The common denominator of that was Jim Jones. Her remains were not found until 2019 in a similar area to Danielle's. While they were missing, they were dubbed part of the Humboldt Missing Five. It's also commonly known as the Humboldt County Five. It features three other women who also went missing in the area. For years, I saw Danielle's family posting about her case for years on Facebook, but I really didn't know how to help. I know that it also didn't really get that much media attention. And I think that it's really because the area is known for marijuana, and Danielle was also an addict. Her mother is really transparent about her journey and her story. And it's just really hard to see the media not pay attention to those stories just because of that one thing. So when I started this show, she was actually one of the first people that I reached out to. I recorded that episode before the first episode even dropped. And I just told her, you know, who I was, because we hadn't spoken in a really long time, and what I hoped to achieve with it, and that I really wanted to tell her daughter's story with compassion and complexity, and for people to understand Danielle and hear her story through her mom and really just care about the fact that her killer is still free. I wanted people to walk away from that episode knowing more about Danielle's life and what led her down this path. And I don't feel like they just knew her as a person on the inside and not just that she was another drug addict who was murdered in Humboldt County, because there's a lot of problems in Humboldt County. And that's usually what people end up just reverting to. So Jim Jones has been publicly named as a person of interest in Sheila and Danielle's case. I also spoke with a detective on the case, and he basically said to me that he thinks that it's a strong case, but it's in the DA's hands. So I was like, all right, what can I do? And I started a petition that launched with the episode to, I don't know, push them to, at a minimum, re-interview people and provide a public update on the case, because there hasn't been any updates since 2019, since Sheila's remains were found. It's hard getting attention on a case like this, but I was really fortunate that outlets like Oxygen and other Humboldt local outlets did pick it up and give it some attention. The petition was a bit of a struggle. I'm not going to lie. I haven't really talked about the petition, but I think it's important to. I also want to preface my gratitude for the people who have signed it or had me come on their show and talk about Danielle and give her case and the petition visibility, you know, Oxygen, other news outlets and podcasts. Like, Billy Joe is really grateful too. So I don't want to diminish that gratitude and the achievement of having almost 1,500 signatures. But the reality behind that, that I haven't talked about, is how many people haven't signed it. I don't know if it's just that it's my first one and I'm not doing it right, but I can see how many people look at that petition versus the number who have signed it. And I'll just say that probably less than 10% have actually signed that petition.
It's still active, right?
It is.
We'll have it in our show notes.
Perfect.
So when we were discussing your episodes, you cited two particular examples you were proud of in terms of building strong collaborative stories, despite having a lack of available material, which is something I can really relate to. One was the case of Kimberly Morse, and one was the case of Ray Levesque. Can you talk to me about what was and wasn't available in each case, why you think it was missing, and your solution to creating each episode? And I'd like to hear, like, what some of your techniques are as well.
We could probably nerd out about research forever, because I'm such a research nerd too. We basically just try to find everything that is publicly available on a case. We have several different online archives that we use to gather all the newspaper coverage. We try to go as hyper-local as we possibly can and gather literally everything that we could possibly find, and blend that with what the family tells us, because sometimes that's not enough. I would love for newspaper coverage to be enough, but sometimes it's not. So in these two cases, there really wasn't enough to tell a full episode beyond like 5 minutes. And in those situations, which I, you know, come up against a lot, I'm like, okay, I need family support with this. In Ray's case, his daughter actually reached out to me and asked if I would cover her dad's case. So a lot of that episode comes from her memory and her stories about her dad. And there's probably like, I don't know, 6 articles. So we try to just blend those as much as possible, because sometimes people's memories, like their dates are wrong and stuff like that. But as far as experience goes, we really go with what the family's story is. With Kim, There was some coverage on the murder, but there was nothing really about her life, other than the fact that she was a, quote, exotic dancer, which, you know, the media really loved to talk about. So otherwise, there really wasn't much about her. So we spoke with about three different people and really just got everything they remembered about Kim's life and her murder and the investigation and then the aftermath. And that really shaped the story. That one, actually, both of them are really like more victim homage, like portraits, because more than half the episode is just about their life. And I mean, you don't even know that they've died. Other than that you're listening to a true crime podcast and you most likely know that the case is unsolved at that point, but it's really a victim's portrait so you can get to know them as a person. And I really feel confident that with both of them, we were able to do that. If you Google Ray Levesque, the Maine State Police blurb is the only thing that really comes up. And it's pretty much just, this is his name. This is where he died. This is when. If you have any info, please contact us. And I just think that there needs to be more for people to talk about this and want to share it on their social media. There just needs to be something worth talking about that's more than just this blurb. Not that like the fact that their case is unsolved isn't worth talking about, but there just needs to be something more. So now, if you Google his name, he has a full page on Google that's dedicated to his life and his death. And all of the resources are there that we use, which, I mean, for that one is very limited. But all the photos, you know, we had tons of amazing photos that Julia shared with us. And the same with Kim's family. So I think that being able to see photos and hearing from people who knew them just really compels people to want to share stuff about this person. And yeah, so that's kind of what we did with that, is really just turn what was not on Google into something that's like an homage to them.
That's really similar to what we try to do, which is at the very base, create a workable knowledge base on a case that didn't have one so that people can share it, talk about it. Hopefully, families can then take it to other people and say, look, mm-hmm. we do have information, which makes, you know, news outlets more apt to cover them, which makes other podcasters, TV shows more likely to speak to them. So it kind of, you know, like you're saying, it creates that Google page. It creates that information source that makes the next step so much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Like that hard work, the road is starting to be paved for that work that's already done. So, you know, we hope that somebody takes this and expands on it.
Have you begun to see any shifts in podcasting in regard to ethics? And I really mean ethics as widely as you want to interpret that, right? I mean, that can mean research, writing, plagiarism. It can mean topic and approach, consent, participation, treatment of topics, families. I'm just really interested in how you see the shape of the industry from then to now, and maybe even where it might be headed.
Honestly, I think it's changed a lot, and I've only been in it for 2 years. About 2 years ago, I feel like the seeds were being planted to move in a more ethical direction as far as like, you know, true crime content and family consent and keeping them in mind, and less of the like, you know, strictly entertainment, gossipy type of stuff that's still super, super popular. But I feel like probably in the last year that this has kind of been pushed more to the forefront, and it's great. And also I see a lot of people scrambling who haven't been creating very ethical content that are like, oh crap, I need to make my content ethical. What do I do? And it just really makes me glad that I made the choice. Not that I would have done it any other way, because I didn't ever want to do it any other way, but I'm just like, okay, so I did make the right choice with the content that I wanted to create. As far as plagiarism goes, I still think we have a long way to go. I'm sure you've been plagiarized many times. And as you know, having something that is the only hit on the internet is just, it's just ripe for plagiarism.
It sure is.
Oh, I don't think I answered your last question, which is where it's headed. I think it's heading in a really good direction. I think it's heading in a direction where survivors and families are more comfortable speaking out and telling their story and creating their own content and kind of just taking grasp of their stories, which for the past like decade plus have been just told by strangers who are just wanting to make money off of it and consume it for entertainment. So I'm really glad to see more families and survivors taking up space in a genre that is inherently theirs.
Yeah, family and survivor creators are probably my favorite part of this shift myself.
Yes, I love that.
Do you have advice for anyone who's interested in victim advocacy? And this doesn't necessarily have to be like as a podcaster. I know we have a lot of listeners who are just people who would love to help. What are some things they could do and some things they should avoid?
I feel like a lot of people don't really know what to do sometimes. You know, you're like, well, I don't live in Georgia. How can I help this case? Or something like that. And I really think that there is so much power in social media sharing or signing a petition, just really easy, simple things. And I know that people hear it all the time on podcasts, but I just really like to emphasize the importance of that for people who are like, you know what, I want to be more ethical in the way that I consume content. I want to try to sign the petitions that I see or repost missing posters. I think that it's just so helpful. So I feel like that's a really good place to start. And then, you know, if you have an extra $5 to spare, there are so many GoFundMes that are working for such a great cause, like the Leona Lorelis movement that's raising money for such an incredible cause. There's just a lot of podcasters out there that I feel like are pushing these little things forward to their audience because they need that help. Even with a case like Reeves Johnson, you know, I'll approach people on the street, like when we were doing the street team, and they're like, well, I didn't live here. I don't know anybody. And I'm like, but you never know who is on your friends list that you don't know might know something or might know somebody who might know something. So it's just this like interconnected web of things that could help a case.
The final thing I'd like to ask you is I would love for you to recommend an episode to us that we haven't discussed today that you'd really like our audience to listen to.
One of my favorite episodes is The Life and Death of Amy Lynn Drake. It's so short. It's only 20 minutes. It was actually one of the first episodes that I ever did. The information available is super light. I actually re-released it last month, but it was really the first time that I realized the power of hearing about victims firsthand from people who loved them. And I saw this episode transform and change with what the guest was saying. Amy was an addict, and that pretty much colors how all the news articles talked about her after the murder, which is still unsolved. And I spoke with her friend, and it was just so endearing and so beautiful. And I really got to understand who she was through his stories and have the opportunity to portray her as more than just an addict who got murdered. So that episode just really has my heart, and I absolutely recommend it.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And we will make sure to not only have links to your show and the socials and the show notes, but also to the petition.
Thank you.
To sign petitions for Danielle and listen to more of Murder, She Told, check out the links in our show notes. We'd be really interested to hear more from other creators with unique or specialized training who are doing advocacy work through their shows. So reach out to us and let us know what you're working on. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is an independently produced show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us over on Patreon. All our Patreon earnings fund the Millbrook Twins billboard and go to the therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes for $5 a month. We've also added occasional live streams and blogs, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. If you prefer Apple Premium, we're beginning that feed as well, so you can have an alternative way to contribute. Again, 100% of these funds go to support the Billboard and Therapy Fund. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kiana Burgess, and Michaela Morrow. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd, Liz Lipka, and Sarah Turney. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the services of PIs.